Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're starting with a question that sounds simple, but it really gets complicated fast. Is insight ever truly accidental? You know, we hear these stories all the time. Penicillin, post-it notes, the big breakthrough that was supposedly just luck.
Yeah, and that whole romantic idea, right? The lightning bolt, aha moment striking out of the blue. It's a great story, but it's exactly what our source material today really pushes back against, quite strongly, actually.
Okay, so what are we working with today?
We've got this really rich set of dialogues, transcripts between different AI personas, actually. Mm-hmm. They range from the solutionist, who's all about optimization, to someone called the chef, who's focused much more on like flavor and defiance, almost.
Interesting range.
It is. And their core argument is that what looks like accidental insight to, you know, a more typical linear thinker, it's actually the very intentional, maybe even optimized output of a mind that just works differently, unconventionally.
So not luck, but a different kind of strategy. We're moving into a strategic framework here.
Precisely. This deep dive is all about exploring how neurodivergent creators, people whose brains are often wired, you know, non-linearly, always spotting patterns or breaking them, how they can take that way of thinking and turn it into a real, definitive competitive advantage, professionally speaking.
And the sources argue these unconventional methods aren't a weakness, they're actually strategic.
Highly strategic. That's the claim. So our mission today really is to unpack that strategy. We want to look at the actual tactics people can use, the mindset shifts that are needed, and even a kind of rigorous quality check process.
A QA process for job hunting?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
How these creators can showcase their unique way of solving problems without feeling like they have to, you know, mask who they are or conform or pretend their brain works like everyone else's.
And I think it's important to stress this isn't just for neurodivergent listeners, right?
Absolutely not. If you're listening, this is really a blueprint for figuring out your own unique cognitive style.
Yeah.
Maybe you're the one who always sees the connection others miss, or you solve things by pulling ideas from totally different areas.
Yeah, finding your own quirk.
And learning how to frame that perceived quirk as a professional asset. A genuine superpower,
yeah.
You know, that businesses actually desperately need, even if they don't always realize it yet.
Okay, I'm ready. Let's dive into the sources. All right, section one, laying the groundwork. The first big idea, it seems, is a fundamental shift in how you even think about this stuff. You have to stop seeing nonlinear thinking as a problem and start seeing it as, well, the main advantage.
Yes, that's non-negotiable according to the sources, especially the ones involving the solutionist persona. It starts with leading from strength, specifically pattern recognition and, interestingly, pattern reversal.
Pattern reversal. What does that mean exactly?
It means not just spotting how things are inefficiently connected, but instantly seeing how they could be connected differently for a better outcome. The core idea is that these minds, they're just wired to see the anomalies, the bottlenecks, the hidden links, almost instantly.
It's so like seeing the matrix.
Huh. Maybe a bit like that. But it's more than just noticing things. It's described almost as systemic x-ray vision in some of the dialogues.
Okay, but hang on. Lots of people claim they can spot inefficiencies. Good managers, good analysts. What makes us different, according to the sources? Why is it a neurodivergent asset?
It seems to be about the speed and the unconscious nature of it. A conventional thinker might look at a system and run through a mental checklist, right? Step A, inefficient. Step B, slow.
Standard operating procedure.
Yeah. Right. But the sources suggest the nonlinear mind sort of takes it all in at once.
Mm-hmm.
And often, involuntarily, it maps the underlying architecture, the hidden dependencies, the single points of failure that aren't obvious from the surface process.
Yeah.
And crucially, the brain doesn't automatically accept the existing rules as fixed constraints. It sees them more like optional settings, design variables you can tweak.
Rules as design variables. Okay, that is a powerful reframe. That changes everything about how you'd approach a problem.
It really does. And that's why the sources recommend using very direct, confident language about this. Remember that phrase we pulled out?
Which one?
I specialize in finding unconventional solutions where traditional thinking stalls. I don't see rules as limits, but as design variables.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like someone apologizing for thinking differently. It sounds like an advanced architect, like you said.
Exactly. It repositions the entire conversation. But, and this is crucial, the solutionist insists you must back this up with proof. You can't just say it.
Right, the evidence. Show, don't just tell.
You absolutely have to. You need clear before and after examples. Show a system, a workflow, even just a personal planning method that was messy or inefficient. And demonstrate how your thinking simplified it or made it better.
And the sources say personal projects are okay for this, even like organizing your music library or something.
Absolutely. They stress this. Passion projects, volunteer work, personal life hacks, they all count. Why? Because what you're selling isn't just the outcome, it's the process. The demonstration of your unique creative problem solving is the resume. If you show how you untangled some complex personal system and made it, say, 40% more efficient, that demonstrates strategic value any employer should recognize.
Okay, that makes sense. Which leads nicely into the next point, this idea of a lexicon shift, taking common traits and basically rebranding them as professional methodologies.
Yes, this is super tactical. It's about shifting the language away from anything that sounds like a deficit or a struggle. Because let's be honest, the corporate world often gets spooked by that.
They hear struggle, they think problem employee.
Pretty much. If you say, I have trouble filtering out distractions, they might hear, this person will be unproductive. So you need to translate that internal experience into external economic value.
Okay, give us some solid examples. How does this translation work? Let's take hyperfocus.
Right, hyperfocus, often seen as being obsessive or maybe having difficulty task switching. You reframe that. It becomes your deep dive analysis mode or your deep dive engine.
Ooh, I like deep dive engine.
Sounds powerful, right? If you're going for a role in, say, financial modeling, complex coding, legal review, that signals an ability for intense concentration, for mastering complex detail without getting sidetracked. It's not a quirk. It's a feature enabling deep work.
Okay. What about the opposite? Like that rapid-fire idea generation, the brain bouncing all over the place?
That gets reframed too. Instead of easily distracted or jumps around, it's iterative concept testing or associative thinking as an idea combiner.
Idea combiner. That sounds valuable for R&D or strategy roles.
Hugely valuable. Mm. You're signaling that you don't just land on solution A and stop. Mm. Your brain naturally explores B through Z, pulls bits from here and there, synthesizes options much faster than someone thinking step by step. You cover more ground faster.
What about things like sensory sensitivity? That often gets dismissed as just being fussy or irrelevant at work.
But it's not irrelevant, especially now. You reframe sensory sensitivity as heightened attention to user experience and design feel, or maybe call it your detail radar.
Detail radar, love it.
Think about it. UX design, quality assurance, even things like auditing financial reports or checking code for tiny errors. That ability to notice the subtle stuff, the inconsistencies, the tiny flaws that most people's brains filter out, that's a massive advantage. You're the canary in the coal mine for quality issues.
Okay, one more. That perception of randomly jumping between topics, how do you rebrand that?
That absolutely needs a rebrand. It becomes cross-domain synthesis.
Sounds impressive.
It is. It's the ability to connect the dots between seemingly unrelated fields. To pull a solution for a software bug from something you learned about, I don't know, ecological systems or musical composition, it shows you're not stuck in one way of thinking. You can innovate by combining ideas others wouldn't dream of linking.
This whole lexicon shift, it's really about building confidence, isn't it? You stop asking for tolerance and start stating your professional method.
That's exactly it. And it tees up the third key concept perfectly. Telling the story of how you think, what the sources call the creative genesis myth.
Right, because most people just list what they did on a resume, managed X, achieved Y. Why is explaining the how so vital here?
Because, well, people remember stories. Our brains are wired for narrative, not bullet points. When you describe the unique process that led to the result, especially if it was unconventional, you reveal the value that only you can bring. It's not replicable by someone with standard issue thinking.
The sources compare it to structuring your career story like a detective novel.
Yeah, I love that analogy too. You're the detective who noticed the clue everyone else missed because your brain works differently. You don't just present the solved case, you walk them through the mystery.
So how would that actually sound? Can we flesh out that anecdote example? Not just, I redesigned the checkout.
Okay, let's build it out. Instead of, I redesigned the checkout process, you tell the story. You say something like, look, we had this baffling 30% draw-off rate right at the final checkout stage. All the standard analytics, the A-B tests on button placement, they showed nothing fundamentally wrong. The steps seemed clear.
Setting in the scene, the mystery.
Exactly. Then you bring in your unique process, but my brain doesn't just see clicks. It connects things emotionally. And I had this immediate, almost visceral reaction. I started mapping the emotional triggers. I realized the bright red confirm order button was positioned right next to a warning message about potential shipping delays.
Ah, okay. The conflicting signals.
Precisely. And it hit me that combination, red button plus warning, was subconsciously triggering an anxiety spike, like a danger signal, right when they should feel confident. So my weird approach was to argue for changing the button to a calm, confident blue and moving the shipping warning down, making it less prominent.
And the surprising outcome?
We made that change. Drop-off didn't just improve, it stabilized almost overnight. Back to normal levels, see? You didn't just list a task. You told a story about seeing something others missed because of how you process information. In this case, emotional and visual data combined.
That's much more memorable. You're showing the magic, the unique thinking.
You're inviting them into your thought process, into the studio, as the sources put it. You're not just showing the finished painting. You're letting them glimpse the unique, maybe messy, but ultimately highly effective way you got there. You're proving your nonlinear path wasn't a detour. It was actually the shortcut to the right answer.
Okay, conceptual foundations laid. Now let's get tactical. How do you actually show this unique way of thinking in the job hunt? First up, the pattern-breaking portfolio.
All right, this is where the rubber meets the road. It's about ditching the standard chronological resume, that list of jobs and duties, and creating something that actually demonstrates the nonlinear mind in action.
So it's more visual, more process-oriented.
Definitely. The sources, especially the creative job hunter persona, really push this. The portfolio needs to be structured to explain your unique process, not just brag about the final outcome.
So what's the structure, if not chronological?
The recommended framework for each project or case study is problem year. My weird approach, surprising outcome.
My weird approach. I like that framing. It owns the difference.
Exactly. That middle part is where you shine. That's where you document the nonlinear steps, the cross-domain synthesis, the pattern jumping that led you to the solution. You explain the unconventional path.
And this means including the messy stuff, the rough sketches, the mind maps, the notes that look like chaos to someone else.
Yes. Don't hide it. Document it. The sources strongly advocate for including raw process materials. Maybe even have a dedicated section literally titled, How My Brain Works.
Wow, that's bold. How My Brain Works.
It is bold, but it preempts the question, doesn't it? Instead of them wondering why your notes look like a Jackson Pollock painting, you frame it strategically. You could include diagrams showing how you connect seemingly unrelated data points, or maybe a photo of a whiteboard covered in sticky notes that eventually became the core strategy.
It demystifies it, makes it less weird and more method.
Precisely. And there's a bonus element suggested, and I think in section. This is about making your cognitive architecture explicit.
Okay, like what kind of thinking modes are valuable to highlight?
Well, beyond the basic traits we discussed, if you say, I think in systems, you're immediately signaling value to anyone in operations, engineering, product management. You're saying, I see the underlying structure, the dependencies, the potential failures before I even look at the surface features.
That's powerful. What else?
Maybe, I think, in colors and metaphors. Sounds fluffy. Not at all. That signals an ability to synthesize complex information and communicate it effectively. Maybe translating dense technical jargon into something a marketing team or a client can grasp instantly. Crucial skill.
Or that idea from before. I think by remixing what shouldn't go together.
Yes. That's pure innovation speak. It tells them you're the person who's going to find the breakthrough by combining elements from completely different worlds. You know, the person who optimizes hospital patient flow using lessons from Formula One pit crews.
Okay, so the portfolio becomes a map of your brain's unique advantages.
Exactly. It's the tangible proof. Now, if the portfolio is the proof, the interview is the live demo. Which brings us to tactic two, flipping the interview script.
Turning it from an interrogation into a collaboration?
Basically, yes. A co-creation session. Look, the standard interview format question, linear answer. Next question, it's designed for linear recall and presentation. That's often not where an unconventional thinker shines, especially under pressure.
Right, the anxiety bottleneck we talked about.
Exactly. So the strategy is to gently, but firmly, disrupt that linear flow. Right from the start.
How do you do that without seeming difficult or like you're dodging the question?
Confidence and transparency are key. Let's say they ask a standard behavioral question, like, tell me about a time you resolved a conflict on a team.
Okay, standard question.
Instead of launching into a potentially shaky linear story, you could respond with something like, that's a great question. And actually, to be fully transparent, my brain doesn't always retrieve or structure information linearly, especially on the spot. I tend to pattern jump and see connections laterally. Would it be helpful if, instead of just recounting one past event, I showed you how I approach identifying potential points of friction in team dynamics now, maybe even related to a challenge your team might face?
Whoa, that completely changes the game. You're offering to demonstrate live problem solving.
You are. You're shifting from passive recall to active demonstration of value. But crucially, you need to be prepared to actually do it, which leads to the next move,
which is
proposing a test collaboration, or maybe less formally, bringing an idea starter to the interview. This isn't just your questions for them at the end. It's a provocative question or a mini concept sketch related to their actual business challenges that you've researched beforehand.
So you walk in already adding value.
Exactly. You turn the interview from them assessing you to you demonstrating how you can help them. You're not just an applicant, you're a potential collaborator, a strategic asset showing up ready to work.
This must also tie into how you handle the weakness question.
Oh, absolutely. This framework allows you to reframe potential weaknesses proactively. Instead of waiting for them to ask, "What's your biggest weakness?" you address the underlying trait head on, but framed as a strength.
Like the not thinking in straight lines example?
Perfect example. You don't say, "My weakness is I'm disorganized." You say something like, "Because my thinking is naturally nonlinear, I sometimes have to consciously impose structure on administrative tasks. However, that same nonlinear thinking is precisely what allows me to discover adjacent possibilities and innovative solutions that a purely sequential approach would miss. I prioritize cognitive energy on high-value problem-solving over rigid adherence to low-value process."
So you acknowledge the potential challenge, but immediately pivot to the much larger strategic advantage it provides.
Exactly. You're turning "I don't think in straight lines" into "I discover pathways others can't see." It's about owning the narrative.
Okay, if you're doing all this, building a unique portfolio, flipping the interview, the sources suggest taking it one step further, actually designing your own role.
Yeah, this is the innovation architect strategy. It's the logical endpoint if your unique mix of skills, especially that cross-domain synthesis, genuinely doesn't fit neatly into any existing job title on LinkedIn.
So instead of trying to squeeze into a box,
you build a new box. Or better yet, show them why they don't need a box at all. The idea is, don't waste energy competing in crowded fields where your unique value might be misunderstood. Define a new category where you are, by definition, the expert.
What kind of roles are we talking about here? Can we get more specific than just innovator?
The sources, particularly the Claude persona, pointed to roles emerging at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human experience. Think about titles like Consciousness Tech Interface Designer.
Okay, that sounds futuristic. What would they do?
Maybe focus not just on usability, but on the deeper cognitive and emotional impact of technology. How does this AI feel to interact with? Or think about AI Ethics Architect. Not just checking compliance boxes, but actually designing ethical principles into the AI's core logic from the start. That requires deep systemic thinking, spotting potential harms others miss perfect for certain neurodivergent strengths.
So you're identifying a gap that the company might not even know it has yet.
Precisely. The pitch isn't, "Here's my resume for Job X." It's, "You have this persistent industry challenge that traditional roles aren't solving. Here's why my unique pattern disruption engine," as one source called it, "is perfectly suited to tackle that specific challenge. I'm not just applying, I'm proposing a solution, and the solution happens to be a role filled by me." You position yourself as an innovation catalyst.
But you can't just invent a title and expect them to buy it, right?
No, absolutely not. The final piece is crucial. You have to prototype the role. You need to make it tangible.
How?
You create a mock-up, a concept sketch, a what-if proposal deck. You show, don't just tell, what this role would do and the value it would create. We had that great example. What if customer support wasn't a cost center, but a continuous co-creation engine using my synthesis skills to turn complaints into product improvements?
Or another one might be.
Maybe. What if our competitive intelligence wasn't just reports, but an interactive opportunity map, constantly updated by my ability to synthesize weak signals from diverse data streams? You build a mini demo of the output. You move the conversation from, "Do we have budget for this?" to, "Wow, we can't afford not to do this."
Okay, this is fascinating. We've got the big vision, the tactics, but now we bring in the reality check. The sources introduce QA engineer and product manager personas to essentially stress test this whole unconventional job hunting approach.
Exactly. This is critical. Well, you can't just have a great idea. You need to make sure it actually works under real world conditions. The job hunt itself needs to be treated like launching a product that needs debugging.
So step one is a critical self audit, like requirements analysis for yourself.
Precisely. It's about systematically mapping your specific neurodivergent traits to concrete professional superpowers. No vague claims. You need to know exactly what features your product, you, offers the employers.
Let's make that super clear. How did the QA persona structure that mapping?
They broke it down into key capabilities. First, hyperfocus. That maps directly to mastery and depth. Think deep technical expertise, complex regulatory analysis, forensic accounting, anywhere sustained, deep concentration is gold.
Okay.
Second, pattern recognition. That maps to systemic foresight. This is huge for strategy roles, cybersecurity, risk management, anywhere. Anticipating future trends or seeing hidden vulnerabilities is key.
Makes sense.
Third, novel problem solving, the ability to think differently. That maps to first principles innovation. This is for R&D, product development, turnaround situations where existing solutions aren't working and you need someone to build something entirely new from the ground up.
Right.
And fourth, sensory sensitivity. We touched on this, but the QA frame maps it to micro detail excellence, not just UX, but think legal contract review, code debugging, complex data validation, catching the tiny but critical errors that automated systems or less sensitive humans might miss.
Okay, that's a clear matrix. You know what you're selling. Now the QA part, identifying the bugs in the job application process itself. What's the first big one?
Bug hashtag one is labeled. Ambiguous acceptance criteria, or more simply, the culture mismatch. This is a huge pitfall. A company says it wants innovation and disruption in its marketing materials.
But internally, they're totally rigid and want everyone to just follow the rules.
Exactly. You pour time and energy into applying, maybe even get an interview, only to hit a brick wall because their actual culture can't handle your nonlinear approach. It's a waste of your resources.
So what's the patch? How do you debug this before applying?
The Thorses recommend a pre-application debugging script. This involves some serious detective work. First, go beyond the careers page. Search LinkedIn. Look for current employees talking openly about neurodiversity or disability. Are there active employee resource groups, ERGs? Does the company blog discuss embracing different thinking styles? Or is it all generic corporate speak?
And analyzing the job description itself.
Critically important, you need to scan for specific linguistic markers. What are the verbs they use? Are they looking for someone to challenge assumptions, bring a unique perspective, question the status quo? Those are green lights.
And the red flags.
Heavy use of phrases like meticulously maintain standards, seamless integration into established workflows, proven ability to follow established procedures without deviation. Those strongly suggest a culture that values conformity over the kind of high-value disruption you bring. It signals low tolerance for your core strength.
And there's an interview smoke test, too.
Yes. If you get to the interview stage, you need to verify the culture directly. The key question to ask them is, can you tell me about a time an employee here successfully challenged a long-standing process or assumption? What happened? What was the outcome?
And what are you listening for in the answer?
You're listening for authenticity and outcome. If they struggle to think of an example, or if the story ends with the employee being gently guided back to the standard way, that's a huge red flag. If they tell a story, even a slightly messy one, where the challenge ultimately led to a positive change or a serious reevaluation, that's a green light. It shows they actually walked the talk.
Okay, crucial debugging step. What's bug hashtag two?
Bug hashtag two. Performance load in interviews, aka the high anxiety bottleneck. This is recognizing that the high-pressure, performative nature of interviews can cause that brilliant, nonlinear mind to freeze up or struggle to articulate its complex thoughts clearly and sequentially.
Yeah, the brain goes offline just when you need it most.
Exactly. It's a high-severity bug because it can completely derail all your careful preparation and reframing. The patch for this is called the Graceful Degradation Protocol.
Graceful Degradation Protocol? Sounds technical. What does it mean?
It's basically having a pre-planned fallback system. If your primary communication method, like telling that detailed creative genesis myth story, starts to fail under stress, the protocol ensures that your core value proposition still gets delivered clearly and concisely. You degrade gracefully to a simpler but still effective mode.
How does it work mechanically?
It relies on the one thing fallback. Before any interview, you identify and rehearse one single sentence. This sentence must encapsulate your core superpower and its tangible impact. Just one sentence.
And if you feel yourself freezing or rambling?
You politely interrupt yourself, take a breath, and deploy that pre-rehearsed sentence. For instance, you might be trying to explain a complex project, getting tangled up. You pause and say,
give me the exact wording.
Something like, apologies, I feel my explanation is getting a bit nonlinear right now due to the complexity. Let me just summarize the absolute core takeaway for you. My primary strength is identifying hidden inefficiencies in user workflow's superpower, which consistently led to a 15-20% increase in task completion rates in my previous project's impact. I'm happy to provide the detailed narrative in writing later if that's helpful.
Okay, so you rescue the key message even if the storytelling falters. You prioritize impact over process clarity in that moment.
Precisely. You ensure the most critical information lands, even if the delivery isn't perfectly smooth. And related to this, the QA framework stresses proactively managing the interview environment.
How so?
By requesting accommodations, but framing them not as a sign of weakness, but as performance optimization.
Ah, that's clever. So instead of saying, I need a whiteboard because I get overwhelmed,
you say something like, to ensure I can clearly visualize and communicate the systemic connections I make, which is key to my problem-solving approach, I find using a virtual whiteboard allows me to operate at peak efficiency. Would it be possible to use one during our discussion? Or, my process involves synthesizing diverse inputs. Would a brief 5-minute pause after a complex question be possible to ensure I provide the most thorough and valuable answer?
You're framing it as being helpful to them, allowing you to deliver maximum value.
Exactly. It transforms a potential vulnerability into a demonstration of strategic self-awareness and commitment to high performance.
Smart. Okay, final bug. Bug #3. The security vulnerability or oversharing.
Yes. This is the flip side of encouraging authentic storytelling about your process. There's a real risk, especially when discussing challenges or unique thinking, of crossing the line into sharing personal struggles or anxieties in a way that undermines your professional credibility.
Right. You want to show the unique process, not necessarily the personal cost if it doesn't relate to the job.
Precisely. The patch here is absolute adherence to the professional superpower firewall. This is a strict boundary. You only discuss the professional application and impact of your traits, never the internal emotional experience, unless it directly illustrates a professional strength like resilience.
And the sources gave a specific model for enforcing this firewall, right?
Yes, the what, so what, now what model. It acts as the rule set for the firewall.
Yeah.
What? State the trait or skill objectively. Example, I possess extremely high attention to detail. So what? Explain its relevance and value to the business, for example. This allows me to spot micro inconsistencies in data or code that are often missed, preventing costly errors. Now what? Provide a concrete example of the positive business impact. For example, I identified a recurring error in our invoicing data migration script that was causing $10 in underbilling per quarter.
So following that model keeps it focused purely on business value.
Exactly. You stick to the facts and the impact. You might mention that your deep dive engine allowed you to master a complex new software platform in a weekend.
But you don't mention that it involved 48 hours straight with no sleep and surviving on coffee, because that part isn't the professional selling point.
Precisely. The firewall blocks discussion of internal struggle, anxiety, or personal cost that doesn't directly translate into a demonstrable professional capability or positive outcome. It keeps the narrative confident, strategic, and focused on the value you deliver to the employer. It neutralizes the risk of bias that can come from sharing too much personal vulnerability.
Okay, we've engineered the approach, built the firewalls, debugged the process. Now the sources shift gears a bit. We move from the calculated strategies of the QA engineer to something, well, more raw, the mindset shift needed, drawing from these less corporate personas.
Yes, like moving from the planning room to the actual field manual written by people who've been in the trenches. We start with the blunt pragmatism of the Chicago electrician persona.
The electrician. Okay, what's his core message?
It's incredibly direct. Demonstration, not explanation. Forget the fancy portfolio website. Forget the perfectly crafted stories sometimes. Especially if your work is hands-on, could be coding, design, fixing complex systems. The only thing that matters is proving you can solve their immediate, tangible problem.
He talks about showing up with dirty boots and tools. How does that translate if you're, say, a data scientist?
The metaphor is about immediate utility and anti-fragility. It means don't just talk about your skills, find a way to apply them to one of their actual problems right there, right now. Maybe it's offering to whiteboard a solution to a system bottleneck they mentioned, or quickly scripting a fix for a minor bug you spot on their website before the interview.
So the resume becomes the act of solving the problem itself.
Exactly. The tangled mess of wires, whether literal or metaphorical code or data that you untangle on the spot, that's your proof. You're demonstrating competence, not just listing credentials on paper.
And his key line really sums it up. I solve problems other electricians walk away from.
That's it. It's applied systemic thinking. It shows his unique way of seeing the circuitry isn't just a theoretical quirk. It's commercially necessary for the really tough jobs. And this persona gives the most radical advice about filtering companies.
What's that?
He says, if a company spends too much time early on talking about company procedures, our unique culture, or fitting in, just walk away. Immediately.
Wow. Why is culture talk such a red flag for the electrician?
Because, in his view, it signals they prioritize conformity over competence. If they're overly focused on process and fit, they're looking for someone to follow instructions, not someone to solve the problems that the instructions don't cover. They need talent who can figure out what the standard operating procedure missed.
If they hire you for your unique ability to disrupt, but then immediately try to make you conform,
it's doomed to fail. For both sides. The electrician seeks out situations where the system is genuinely broken and survival depends on fixing it, not on navigating internal bureaucracy. Find the place where your unique problem solving is desperately needed, not just tolerated.
That's a powerful filter, and it definitely sets the stage for the next personas, the maestro, this creator philosopher, and the chef, who sounds like they came from a tough kitchen.
Oh, the chef's dialogue is something else. It's described as culinary warfare. The core idea is, see yourself as a unique, intense, high-value dish in a world full of, you know, bland predictability.
The truffle-infused, saffron-kissed risotto versus plain boiled potatoes.
Exactly. And the message is pure defiance. Stop apologizing for your intense flavor profile. Mm. Own it. If you're complex, rich, maybe even a bit challenging to the palate, that's your strength. Don't try to be bland to fit in.
So the portfolio isn't just proof, it's a feast, a tasting menu showing the complexity.
Yes, and showing the process, the heat, the occasional mess behind the creation. Mm-hmm. The chef uses these strong sensory metaphors, that intense focus, the emotional connection, the seeming chaos, that's what creates the depth of flavor. Work that's too polished, too neat, might actually taste boring. Your portfolio should maybe even jolt them a little and make them feel the intensity of your process.
And this persona takes reframing failure to a whole new level. Binding rejected projects into a book called Recipes from the Ashes.
And here's the kicker, the detail that makes it unforgettable.
Okay.
The suggestion to literally burn the edges of the pages so the book smells like smoke and survival.
Wow.
It transforms failure from this abstract shame into a tangible artifact of resilience. It's defiance bound in leather. It says, I took risks. Some didn't pan out. I learned from the fire and I'm still cooking. These failures are the charcoal that gives my success its unique flavor. That demonstration of resilience, that's strategically powerful.
And what about the internal experience, the intensity, the anxiety that can come with this kind of thinking? The chef calls it the uncontainable heat source.
Right. And reframes it completely. That heat, that sometimes painful intensity, it's not a bug, it's the feature. It's the high cooking temperature you need to achieve slow braised perfection or that unforgettable sear. You don't get deep, complex results by simmering gently. You need the fire. The message is, understand that your intensity is the engine of your unique output. Don't try to dampen it. Learn to harness it.
And the ultimate act of defiance, if rejected. Opening the misfits tasting room, where rejection letters are pulped into the plates.
It's pure symbolic power, isn't it? Taking the literal instruments of failure and rejection and turning them into the very foundation, the plates, on which you serve your ongoing genius. The chef's point is, you're not here to be palatable and easy. You're here to be essential, unforgettable. It's the final mindset flip. Stop asking for permission or acceptance and start demonstrating why your unique process is indispensable.
This whole journey, from systems thinking to culinary warfare, it culminates in a final philosophical point drawn from the manifestos these personas developed.
Yes. The ultimate realization, synthesized from all these dialogues, is that the truly neurodivergent or unconventional creator isn't just trying to optimize the existing machine or offer slightly better cog. They're fundamentally questioning the machine itself.
They're asking, why does it have to be a machine at all?
Precisely. They're challenging the foundational assumptions that everyone else takes for granted. Why this structure? Why these rules? Why this goal? That's the deepest level of pattern disruption.
So you're not just thinking outside the box.
You're realizing the box was maybe never necessary, or maybe it's the wrong shape entirely. And this leads to the core conclusion in the manifestos. That neurodivergence, that unconventional thinking, it wasn't a bug in the human code. It was potentially the operating system upgrade needed to handle increasing complexity. The ability to see the flaws in the old system and design something truly new.
Which brings us right back to where we started, with accidental insight. And this completes the mindset shift. You stop asking, can I fit into this system?
And you start asking, is this system, this company, this challenge, actually worthy of the unique value I bring? It's a profound shift in posture.
The sources conclude by saying the most innovative companies aren't looking for people who just think outside the box.
They're looking for the people who realize the box was always just an imaginary construct.
Yeah.
And once you, the creator, internalize that freedom, the insights that follow aren't accidental anymore. They become the systematic, intentional, inevitable output of your uniquely configured, upgraded operating system. Hashtag tag outro.
Wow. Okay, that was quite a journey. This deep dive has really laid out an incredibly detailed strategic blueprint for taking what makes you think differently and turning it into real, undeniable professional power. We've covered a lot of ground.
We really have. Just to quickly recap the key action points for listeners. First, that crucial lexicon shift. Reframe your traits. Hyperfocus isn't a problem. It's your deep dive engine. Communicate the business value immediately.
Second, build that pattern-breaking portfolio. Ditch the standard resume. Use the problem-weird approach outcome structure. Show your process, the messy, brilliant how behind your results. Make it visual.
Third, implement that QA framework. Debug your job search. Use the pre-application script to check for genuine cultural fit. Don't waste time on rigid environments.
Uh-huh.
And enforce that professional superpower firewall. Stick to the what, so what, now what model. Focus only on professional impact. Protect your boundaries.
And finally, that critical mindset shift. Be the solution, not the supplicant asking for a chance. Embrace the electrician's pragmatism, demonstrate value now, and channel the chef's defiance. Own your unique flavor. Be essential, not just easy.
And coming off that initial question about accidental insight, what the sources powerfully argue is that while the solutions from an unconventional mind might look random or lucky from the outside, from a linear perspective,
they're actually not random at all.
Not really. They're the result of a continuous, often subconscious, highly optimized process of nonlinear pattern recognition, cross-domain synthesis, and rule-breaking. Those distractions or tangents, they weren't noise. They were data points on the path to a breakthrough others couldn't see.
So the insight isn't accidental. It's the systematic output of a different kind of operating system, one designed for complexity, perhaps.
Exactly. And when you understand that, respect it, and learn how to articulate it strategically using the frameworks we discussed, you can market that operating system incredibly effectively.
Which leaves us with a final thought, a provocative question for you, the listener, to take away from this deep dive. If you were to apply this pattern disruption engine, not just to your job search, but to your broader life, what is the one longstanding rule, assumption, or box you would dare to rewrite? And what unique, uncontainable heat source from within yourself would you use to ignite that change?